Well, wasn't that an incredible feast days or what? Absolutely. The Father's so good to us. And that was an incredible shofar blast. That should have been on the recording. That was incredible. Hallelujah. Well, we're going to go ahead and start getting really back into the Torah cycles like we're doing Friday nights. I know we last left off looking at Judah and Tamar, and that's where we're going to continue at in Genesis 38. But before we go ahead and dive right in, there's something that I was reminded about prior to service that was said during Sukkot about the circle that Sister Gloria had made mention. It's genuinely up to us if we want to remain. And we heard the testimonies that went forth, and it's genuinely up to us if we also want to remove ourselves from that. Just because something happens doesn't mean we have to take on the spirit of a victim. And that's something I was meditating on, reflecting on Judah's situation. Because ultimately, there was things that took place in the prior chapter that we saw with Yosef that ultimately you can kind of see him taking to heart in the book of Yasher, chapter 43. And what I thought was incredible about that was there had to be some kind of connection. And I know we're kind of just going right into it, but there had to be some kind of connection there that shows why ultimately, whenever we fast forward all the way to the moment where he meets up with Yosef, that there's a genuine change of character. Because right here in chapter 38, we're seeing his character being challenged, the testing taking forth, and then ultimately preparing him to realize that the Father wants to use him. Because something that I was meditating on is, why not Yosef? I'm sure we all asked that question. Because when you reflect on the difference between the two, it's like bar none, no comparison. But it's ultimately a message of its own, is the fact that the Father can use us even though we go through something. It's just sometimes we prolong the process. And then ultimately, whenever we look at Judah, that's kind of what happened. Because in chapter 34, and I'll leave it up to y'all to go look, but 43 of Yasher, it ultimately says towards the latter part, whenever the boys were weeping because they looked upon their father Yaakov, and he was just bawling, crying his eyes out. And it said that at one point he lay down on the ground and became as still as stone. Well, ultimately, he fell into shock. And I've experienced that feeling before, and you're just pretty much paralyzed because of the situation that's taken place. And then it said, Judah, out of everyone there witnessing, walked over to his father on the ground, got down, and picked up his head and put it on his lap. And it said that he wept exceedingly, a great cry. And that's ultimately showing Judah's heart, showing that he actually was convicted deeply of the things that took place to Yosef being sold away. And we know all the fine details of that. We walked through that. But the reason I bring that up is in light to the fact that we got one or two options. And Brother Scott brought that out in verse 1. That whenever it says, and at that time it came to be Yehuda left, Yared, in a sense of going back to his own ways of handling things, and turned aside. And we learn that's Natsah, to turn aside. So he left, went back to his ways, and turned aside to the fact that, in a sense of branching out, doing things his way, trying to seek consoling his way. Now, all of us can find an Adulamite in our life if we want to. Because we know that Adulam represents a city of refuge. But the Father wants us to make sure that he's our city of refuge. That we go to him. And 38 is a prime example of what we can experience when we don't go to him. Things kind of just don't go the way you want it. And ultimately, Brother Scott pointed out the fact that he lost his two sons. Now, of course, it wasn't condoned by the Father because of where he got his sons from, because he was too busy trying to fix things himself. And that's something that weighed heavy on my heart, is how many times, and once again, it's another example of the handler, except this time it's the handler's son, Judah, that we're looking specifically at. But every time we try and handle things on our own, it only gets worse when we go find ourselves a Adulamite, when we go find someone that will tickle our ear and help us feel a little bit better about our circumstances. And all the wonderful things about that situation was unfolded last week. And I couldn't help but also realize the fact that he genuinely got to experience what his father ultimately experienced. But of course, in Jacob's situation, Yosef was still alive. And I know when me and Brother Scott was talking about it, there are some instances where it does say, some people speculate and say, well, that was the measure that had to be measured back. But in reality, Almighty Yah doesn't operate that way. It all has to do with the fact that he just didn't adhere to the father's instructions not to take of this land. And of course, we see that by the boys' behavior, why the results ended up the way it ended up. And that was just a little quick refreshing into where we're going at next. So I would have had some display up tonight, but I didn't have my iPad with me and didn't charge it. Left it here. I was about to say at home. This is home. Left it here overnight. And I texted the wife and I figured she had it at work. Sometimes we share the iPad. And then she's like, oh, I don't have it. I think you left it at the church. And I was like, I definitely left it at the church. So that's where we're at on that one. And there was only two pictures, but I'll describe them whenever we get to it as best as possible. But let's go ahead and get started in this. And now we're going to be resuming in verse 11 of chapter 38 of Genesis. And now we're going to get more of an in-look of Tamar and the significance she plays here. But it says, then Yehuda said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah is grown, for he said, lest he also die as his brothers did. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So there's a few words of importance that we're going to look at in the Hebrew. And I'm going to go ahead and give the Strong's as I go along. And it is going to be a breakdown of these words. But it is important that we can ultimately learn how to look at it and get that extra look of what's going on. Because something that me and Brother Scott talked about through the week, if we don't look at the Hebrew, then we're just going to read it in its English and try and make it understand to our understanding what we understand. So the first word we're going to look at is daughter-in-law. That's H3618, Kalah, a bride, hence a son's wife. And H, it's one of its roots, the primitive root. H3634, Kalal, to be complete. And I spent a little extra time learning how to read the ancient Hebrew lexicon. And of course, I had a question for Pastor and he helped me out with it too. But it's set up in a certain way to whenever we read it, it points to more of a detail. But whenever you're looking at it in the ancient Hebrew, it's ultimately its parent root. Because a primitive root is usually only three letters that are connected to the rest of the words that it's connected to. And the parent root is the kaf and the lamet. And it's action, that's the AC, colon. Action is complete. The concrete definition is vessel. And abstract definition is whole. So a complete vessel and whole is given daughter-in-law as in this sense, in its Hebraic sense, as someone or something that's ultimately a willing vessel that will complete you in that sense. And it's being used here for a reason, because ultimately we're taking Yehuda to an eye exam, is how I'm going to put it. And we're going to be getting there, because whenever our vision is impaired, there's things that we tend to miss. So that's just a little pre-up to where we're heading with Yehuda. But back to daughter-in-law, Kalal. It is the picture of a bent palm representing the bending or subduing of the will. Now, of course, whenever I read that the first time, I automatically pictured something that Pastor was explaining to us whenever it comes to the receiving the set-apart spirit and having that connection. If we bring our spirit into the situation with his, it's that colliding. But if we humble ourselves and position ourselves correctly, we're able to be overcame by that. And ultimately, we are a vessel. So you can kind of see how this is ultimately starting to point in a direction to where when we see it, it's reflecting on certain key words in Yehuda's life, that these things that he's missing that he needs to be complete in. But But it's that bent palm representing the bending of subduing of the will. And this is describing Tamar. The lamet is the picture of the shepherd's staff or yoke. And when you combine the two, it's tame for the yoke. An animal or land tamed that has been worked and complete, ready for use. And taming includes construction of holding pens, putting the soil to the plow, harvesting of the crops, milk or meat. One eats the harvest when complete. And it's got a subsection that is showing us that you have to go to B. Subsection B, and it says complete whole, something that is whole or a container that holds something completely. And we're going to see that Tamar is exactly that. She is able to be what Yehuda ultimately should have sought out from the beginning. But I genuinely believe that Yehuda, because of his decisions, because of his mind state, because of where he ultimately led himself by his own will, he couldn't see himself being that heir to continue the line of Messiah. He couldn't see himself as anything after what he had did and the pain that he brought to his father. That ultimately kind of makes us realize that might be exactly why he did it for his sons instead of him. Because he went to Aram. He went to the place that they were required to go to find their wives for his sons instead of himself. And we could see that didn't mesh quite well. And that's reminding me of something, that we know what they did with their seed. That it was a bad and disdainful thing in the eyes of the Father. And we know in Genesis chapter 3, when it speaks about the fall, it says there will be enmity between your seed and his seed. And that's another telltale giveaway that's why the Father, in his infinite wisdom, was telling them not to integrate with the land of Canaan. Because they were obviously of the seed of the enemy. And we know that there is no bond with light and darkness. But that was daughter-in-law in the sense of a vessel complete and whole. A vessel that's actually willing to actually receive the Spirit. And widow is Almana, which is H490. Means widow, a desolate place, a desolate house. And Alman is H488. And it's in a sense of bereavement, discarded, forsaken. And its primitive root, Alam, is H481. To tie fast, hence to be tongue-tied, to be bound, dumb or put to silence. So we could see in the sense that it's telling us this widowhood that she was experiencing was ultimately a form of captivity. And I know whenever the Strongs come out in list form and the way that it's coming out at the moment, it can seem a little taxing. But it's literally painting us a picture of what's really going on in her situation. And I've been very prayerful to be able to bring it out in the way that the Father has shown me. So in the ancient Hebrew for this, for widow, it is the mem and alamet, but it's the bind, and it means staff, and there's no abstract definition, but it says with the two combined, it means a staff of might. The shepherd always carries a staff for guiding, leading, and protecting the flock. The flock was bound to the shepherd as the staff was a sign of authority of the sheep. And then it goes on about yoke and being brought together, and then it also speaks about a wound bound with bandages. So we see that as some type of adhesive, some type of taming, some type of yoke. In her situation, she was being locked away because ultimately Yehuda essentially put the blame on her, not understanding what was taking place and not realizing his sons did what they did, that Almighty Yah brought this forth upon them. So he's taken someone that's ultimately appointed and anointed for Yehuda to continue the line and sent her back to her father's house. And we're going to see some beautiful things about who her father is. And I'm sure most of us know the lineage she comes from. But it's absolutely beautiful to follow that breadcrumb trail and then see the bigger picture. But, and I know there's these breakaways that come from the words, and I apologize. But this is exciting to me, and it's good information. So we look at the subsection M for widow, and it just says, as bound in grief. So this is her situation, and it wants us to understand that she is in her father's house, bound in grief, and in a technically in limbo, because she's not ultimately able to remarry in this status because of the fact that he told her to wait for Shelah to grow up. And time goes by, as we're about to read. But let's look at Tamar's father's house. So I have in the book of Yasher, chapter 45, verses 23 through 27. It says, "And in those days, Judah went to the house of Shem and took Tamar, the daughter of Elam, and the son of Shem, for a wife for his firstborn Ur. And Ur came to his wife Tamar, and she became his wife. And when they came to her, he outwardly destroyed his seed, and his work was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord slew him. And after the death of Ur, Judah's firstborn, that Judah said unto Onan, go to thy brother's wife, and marry her as next of kin, and raise up a seed to thy brother." Which Brother Scott went into great detail on all the matters that took place there. "And Onan took Tamar for a wife, and he came to her. And Onan also did like unto the work of his brother, and his work was evil in the sight of the Lord, and he slew him also. And Onan died, and Judah said to Tamar, remain in thy father's house until my son Shelah has grown up. And Judah did no more delight in Tamar to give her to Shelah, for he said, pre-adventure, he will also die like his brothers." So that's another telltale sign of what Judah's ultimate foresight of the situation was. That's why, and we don't have these things right there in Genesis 38. So that's why I enjoy going to the book of Yasher so much, because it does give us those extra details. But the proof text in regards to the genealogy is in Genesis chapter 10, verse 22. Because all it says is the sons of Shem is Elam and Asher and Arpachshad, and Lud and Aram. So I took a moment there and was like just taking time to absorb the information I was looking over at. And sometimes for me, names, every time a Toldot comes up in any way, shape, or form, I get a little excited, because there's a certain part of me that resonates with the understanding of names. So when I was younger, I was always interested in knowing whose name meant what. And I always thought it was neat. You know, Robert stood for great fame. Well, that was cool, you know. I had a little book I found it at, in German roots. But I never would understand that one day I'd be in the position that I'm in now, learning and speaking on these things, that these names, in the same sense, they have a genuine connection to the individual. And it just kind of stood out for me to look at Shem, Elam, and Tamar in reference to Judah. And so I'm gonna give the Strongs for it. Shem is H8035, and it just simply means name, the son of Noah. And its primitive root, H8034, Shem. It says conspicuous position, an affiliation as a mark or memorial of an individuality, and that by implication, honor, authority, and character. And right now we're learning a lot about that, especially whenever it comes to understanding the set apart spirit, because it's an essence, his intrinsic essence, and it embodies his character. And whenever we're able to allow that to take over us, we ultimately reflect his character in return. And interestingly enough, on that note, for the name of Shem, in the ancient Hebrew, its parent root, it says that it's to breathe, breath, and desolate. So the wind or breath of someone or something is its character. And its subsection A, it is breathe, desolate. The Hebrew names are words given to describe character. And that's something that we simply know. But what's interesting is keep in mind that Shem's name ultimately represents the Ruach. It represents the character of Yah, the breath. And then also it has another subsection, and it says, the breath of man is character. What makes one what he is, the name of an individual is more than an identifier, but descriptive of his character or breath. His purpose is attached to that name with the breath that he breathes. Because you remember, we could either have good breath or bad breath. And how we conduct ourselves will really show which breath we have in us. And sometimes I need extra mints, if I could tell on myself, just to be honest. But thank Almighty Yah that he's patient with us. No, let's look at Elam. Let's keep in mind, Shem is connected to spirit. And Elam is H5867, and it is hidden and distant, the son of Shem. And his primitive root, H5956, Elam, is to veil from sight, that is to conceal. And it's ancient Hebrew. The action is speaking of is to hide, and the abstract definition is ancient. And it means beyond the field of vision of time or space. So it's in the sense of something that you have to look further than what's required for normal. To look past, to look deeper within someone's self. And it's something that's hidden. So now we have the spirit of Almighty Yah, and now with Elam, we have the sense of something that's ancient, that's been hidden. And then we look at Tamar, which is H8559, which that just gives you her name. And then it's H8558 is in a sense to be erect a palm tree. And that deals with position and uprightness. So something that represents the Father that's been hidden, that has a position of uprightness, is ultimately being impaired by Yehuda's vision, is what we're starting to see unfold. Because he's so caught up in his lifestyle, so caught up in seeking refuge in the outer parts of the world instead of seeking refuge in the most inward place that the Father's trying to get his attention. That way his character can be matched to him, that he's ultimately becoming blinded by his own ability to function. And that's something that we're being taught, that there's three spirits that we're dealing with in this lifetime. Our own, that was breathed into us. The Father's, that we can ultimately choose. Or we can eat from the other tree, the wrong tree, House of Time. So whichever one we decide to be led by is ultimately going to be determined if our vision is able to see the one that he has set before us. In Judah's instance, it's Tamar, and he's overlooking it. But it's like we said, we're going to take Judah into an eye exam today. Genesis 38:12 says, "And after a long time, the daughter of Shua, Yehuda's wife, died. And Yehuda was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers in Timnah. He and his friend Hara the Adullamite, his patna." And so I really enjoyed some information that Brother Scott had shared with me in regards to the sheep shearing. And it's just very interesting. And this is what ultimately helps us realize that Judah's vision was definitely impaired whenever it came to the sheep shearing. But one thing we had said in regards to the sheep shearing, it kind of gives you the essence of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Him and his little Adullamite partner. But the reason I say these things is because the sheep shearing is connected to a time of festivity. And it's in a sense of, we have things that we can relate to in this topic. We have an orange festival. It's a gathering of plenty and people get together. We have seafood festivals. We have festivals for festivals, so on and so forth. And this is something that we can relate to, right? But what goes on at these festivals? You know, a lot of distractions, entertainment, shining lights, noise, alcohol. Not saying that when we go, that's what we do. But ultimately, Yehuda was in a state of, sure, buddy. When in Timnah, live like Timnans. Timites, I'm sure. So let's look at the different locations that we can actually see about sheep shearing in regards to it. Our first mention is in Genesis chapter 31, something that we were just in not that long ago. And that was in regards to whenever Jacob flees. It says that Jacob takes what rightfully belongs to him for tending Laban's flocks. And right here, I just have verse 17 through 19 to emphasize where it's at. It says, so Jacob rose and put his sons and his wives on camels, and he drove off all his livestock and all his possessions which he had acquired. His property of the livestock which he had acquired in Padan Aram to go to his father Yitzhak in the land of Canaan. In verse 19, and when Laban had gone to shear his sheep, Rachel stole the house idols that were her father's. And it goes on to further say that he was gone for 3 days. That's because they like to take their time whenever they shear the sheep, because it's part of the tradition of the land to ultimately behave in a certain way. Now, the interesting thing is, to this day, there's parts of Israel and parts in the Middle East that still hold the sheep shearing festivals, even in Eastern Europe, the Irish, and so on and so forth. So it's things that are genuinely still practiced to this day, and that's why I brought up the Orange Festival, the Crawfish Festival, all the festivals. It's something that we can ultimately relate to in its environment. And then it made me realize that Laban would have been Mo-mad because he didn't have his little idols with him whenever he got back from that instance. And the reason I bring that up is because there was always something that happened in pertaining to the sheep shearing. And the second one is what we're currently looking at right now with Tamar and Judah. And we're going to get more details of that soon. But another one, and I absolutely enjoyed reading, was David seeks compensation for protecting Nabal's flocks in 1 Samuel chapter 25. I don't have the whole chapter pulled up, but for the sake of the context, verse 1 through 3 says, and Shemuel died, and all Israel gathered and mourned for him, and buried him at his home in Ramah. And David arose and went down into the wilderness of Paran. Now there was a man in Maon, and his work was in Carmel. And the man was very great. And he had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He had plenty. And he came to be shearing his sheep in Carmel. And the name of that man was Nabal, and the name of his wife was Abigail. And she was a woman of good understanding and beautiful, but the man was hard and evil in his doings, and he was of Calib. And the next area we're going to read in there is 35 and 37, but to fill in the gap, just to speak about it, is pretty wild, because David did that service. He ultimately guarded and watched over this sovereign sheep with his over 400 men and simply just sought a payment for his work. And then what's crazy is the sovereign takes it upon himself to be like, David? Who's David? What's that mean to me, basically? He said, man, there sure is a lot of servants running away from their masters these days, basically, in that speech, being very disrespectful in tone. And this matter was being told to the men that David sent forth to receive the compensation. So mind you, David's no slouch. He's a conqueror. They come back, they report to David, but Abigail, mentioning why she is so wise, found out the news, went find David with his men, brought the payment, took care of it right then and there, fell at his feet, showed her servitude towards him, and was able to obtain favor and save many lives. And she said, truly my husband is Nabal, and he truly is Nabal. Then of course, I needed to see the Strongs and Nabal. I don't have to give you the numbers, but she basically was saying he's a dummy, because Nabal means fool, and his root is Baal. So just saying, as plain as day. So now we go to 35 and 37, and it says, and David received from her hand what she had brought him and said to her, go up in peace to your house. See, I have listened to your voice and I have accepted your face. And Abigail went to Nabal, and he was at a feast in his house, like the feast of a sovereign. Sheep shearing feast of a sovereign. So the real big festivals in town. Mardi Gras. All right, I'm going to stop. So, and Nabal's heart was glad within him. I wonder why. And he was exceedingly drunk. So she told him not a word, little or much, until morning light. And it came to be in the morning, when the wine had gone from Nabal, and his wife had told him these matters, that his heart died within him, and he became like a stone. Reality hit. Yeah, that David. And it came to be in about 10 days that Jehovah smote Nabal, and he died. Because it was a matter of fact of word that David straight up said to her, I'll let Almighty Yah decide the fate of those that put themselves in a position of an enemy of me. Didn't have to lay a single hand on that man. And then, of course, it ends with David with a new wife. But we'll go on to the next one. And this is all in light of reflecting on the sheep shearing festivals. You'll notice that common theme is that there's a form of deception and a form of being inebriated, having your vision impaired. Because we know, if we studied, we know what Enaim means, the place of two fountains, and what it represents. But if not, I'm going to bring it up in its proper time. Absalom is the next one. Absalom kills Amnon for raping his sister Tamar in 2 Samuel chapter 13. Now, I just have verse 23 through 28 listed, but I'm sure if we're familiar with it, the beginning of it, it speaks about the fact that Amnon had this obsession for his sister Tamar, sought advice from his friend. His friend said, lay in your sick bed, pretend to be sick, get your father the sovereign to send your sister to you to feed you. And then there's your opportunity, basically. And of course, there was dialogue between the two, her trying to talk some sense into him, but he was too drunk with lust. And ultimately led him to make an embarrassing mistake, and then he wanted to hate her and send her on her way, if she was nothing to him. And then ultimately, that's that flame that sparked inside of Absalom that caused him to decide to do what takes place here. And lo and behold, there's a sheep shearing festival in town. It was starting with verse 23. And it came to be after 2 years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hatzar, which is beside Ephraim. And Absalom invited all the sons of the sovereign. And Absalom came to the sovereign and said, see, your servant has sheep shearers. Please, let the sovereign and his servants go with your servant. But the sovereign said to Absalom, no, my son, let us not all go now, lest we be too heavy on you. And he urged him, but he would not go, and he blessed him. And Absalom said, if not, please let my brother Amnon go with us. And the sovereign said to him, why should he go with you? And Absalom urged him, so he let Amnon and all the sons of the sovereign go with him. And Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, watch, and when the heart of Amnon is glad with wine, and I shall say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not be afraid. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and brave. And all that is brought up in the fact, if we would have just read through 38, and would have been like, oh, they went shave some sheep and Yehuda was just on his way back looking for a good time. Well, no, they went shave some sheep, and because he was inebriated, because he was intoxicated, drunk on being one with the crowd, enjoying the festival, that he ultimately made his decision. But lo and behold, the upright one, Tamar, through deception, was able to regain and maintain the status that she deserved, because she did not deserve to be put in the position that she was put in. She was brought into a situation where she was being used by the land of the Canaanites. But the Father ultimately has this beautiful way of sometimes allowing the mess to unfold, so that way it leads to a big blessing in the end of it. The way he orchestrates things in our lives in a similar manner is kind of mind-blowing sometimes. Because you literally just take time to think how sometimes we do make a genuine mess of ourselves because we're trying to handle things the way that we want. We didn't seek refuge in him. We got some little partner or somebody that, you know, is just always ready to cheer us on all the way straight to the bar room or something. And then you just end up further and further and further and further away out the circle. Yep. But even in the middle of the storm, the Father will allow things to help redirect your attention, redirect your focus, and get you back on track. But it all begins with our ability to actually be able to want to seek him out as a refuge. Whenever we make a mistake, we don't have to beat ourselves up and become a victim. We don't have to resort to the matters of the world to solve our issues. And thankfully, time and time again, when we look at the genealogy, the Toldot of our Messiah, oh, he used some people. That is one swirly looking family tree. But it should be a constant reminder of the fact that no matter how far we may feel gone or may feel like a victim in the moment, he's trying to show us time and time again we're a victor over that moment. And that's the beautiful thing, that whenever you look into this situation, that you could see his hand throughout it all. But be mindful if somebody invites y'all to a sheep shearing fest. So. Oh, hallelujah indeed. Well, let's continue in this Torah portion. Genesis 38:13. And it was reported to Tamar, saying, "See, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." Now, mind you, when she got this information, she probably already knew the inner details of, oh, sheep shearing fest. It's time to go. And the next verse, and she took off her widow's garment. She broke the bondage away, covered herself with a veil. Kind of remind us of Elam, the veilless, the covering. And sat at the entrance of Enaim, which is Patah in Maim, which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown, and he was not given to him as a wife. Now let's deal with Patah in Naim, even though I gave a little bit away. And it's H5879 in Naim, double fountain. And its primitive root is a familiar word for us, ayin. And it deals with the eye and its analogy of the fountain. And its ancient parent root is watch, eye, affliction. So this ultimately kind of is starting to already tell us to watch very intently. That there's something that happens here that involves two different examples of dealing with vision, Tamar's vision and Judah's vision. But it means whenever you combine them, an eye of continuance. And it gives us an example. The nomadic agriculturist carefully watches over his livestock and crops and keeping a close eye on them. It was common to construct a shelter consisting of a roof on four posts as a shelter from the glare of the sun. And its subroot, or its child root, in section M, is the eye reveals the heart of a person. A well, a spring, or a fountain as the eye of the ground. And it's interesting just to take into consideration in that moment that even though Yehuda's vision is impaired, and then Tamar's vision is focused on righting the wrongs, that the entire time the Father's vision is over the entire matter. Now, of course, I had at least two pictures I wanted to show everybody tonight, but I wasn't able to get my iPad set up. But the beautiful thing is, I didn't realize it until early this morning when I woke up praying, that the eye, there's a picture of a blue eye, and enlarged so you can see the color and that inner pupil. The blue eye represents that water, and that inner pupil should remind us of what a fountain looks like, because if we had a drone and would fly it and look down on a normal circular fountain, there's the big part of the eye, the outer eye, and on the center of the fountain, there's a smaller circle which represent the pupil, and that's why it said the ground eye. And that sense, which is really interesting because it gives us that, pun intended, visualization of what Ananaim represents in the sense of what our focuses are like. What is our eye beholding? Because whatever our eye beholds in the situation on the matter is going to determine what we have stored up inside of us. So, in a sense, Petah Enayim is the opening of the eyes. And Yehuda needed his eyes opened. Because he was so far gone and just trying to figure out things himself that he was just making a genuine mess of his life. And thankfully the Father has someone that's upright and that has that hidden inner spirit within them. After the order of Melchizedek, which is of Shem, that ultimately watches over us from the sky down to the ground to make sure that we're taken care of, intercedes for us. Because genuinely, I'll put myself under the bus anytime. I got a CDL, so I can drive it myself too if I have to. But I'll just put it out there. I need all the help possible to make sure my vision's right. Because sometimes it's not just about alcohol. We can be drunk on lust. We could be drunk on anger. We could be drunk on anything else that's not of the Father. We can entitle ourselves with a victimhood mentality to cause our lives to get off of the plumb line that He has set before us. But thankfully, He has an upright one with the Spirit, the ancient Spirit, dwelling within Him that watches over us, that administers it to us, because we're also of the order of Melchizedek. That's what we're operating in. That's our employment. It should be on our tax forms. But it comes with a lot of authority. It does. It really, just to be able to take time and look at the reason that the Father had interjected and resurrected the order of Melchizedek through what Yeshua did with His immersion and then entering into office at the right hand of the Father, that we have that authority as noblemen, as princes and princesses. But of course, I have here, and I wanted y'all to see it too, this time I put emojis in my notes. Double fountain, double iron, double vision. It's got the eyes looking this way, and it's got the little emoji that's all like blurred out. But ultimately, Tamar had both eyes on Judah, and Judah had double vision. So it's important to make sure that we're not in a position where we get double vision. Because intoxication leads to a type of blindness, and we can stumble into one another in ways that's not fruitful. So, I was really meditating on Yehuda's situation, thinking about what's some of the words of the Messiah that could come to remembrance, and dealing with Yehuda's character development and the things that he was struggling with. And of course, we know that Yehuda has struggled with greed and dealt with control of power and different things like that. But it all comes from, it starts with the eyes. We're speaking a lot about the eyes right now. And a lot of us are very familiar with this. Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 through 24. Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, neither where moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart shall be also. The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, all your body shall be enlightened. But if your eye is evil, all your body shall be darkened. If then the light that is within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? And I remember early in my walk, I always wondered, well, what do you mean? Why do you even say how great is the darkness? Darkness is not great at all. Darkness is bad. I'm like, yeah, Robert, darkness is bad. So what's interesting about it is I genuinely understand it a lot better now with time and consistency. Is in Yehuda's sense, in the sense of what we're talking about, if getting tore up from the floor up is your lifestyle and the only way of means of escape, how great is that? And that could be applied to any direct sin that we may be dealing with or struggling with or whatever may be going on or in reflection of. How great is it? So I remember the times in my life where I was trying to handle things my own. I didn't know the Father. I just thought I was going to just be this victim broken to the circumstances that my life had unfolded before me, and a lot of it by my own hands, and would rinse and repeat the same routine. I've experienced double vision. I've experienced no vision. I experienced moments where I could have been on the television. And I'm talking about Bad Boys. So it's just the reality of it, is that we ultimately, it all begins with our eye. And the Father wants us to have our eyes fixed on Him. And no one is able to serve two masters, for either he shall hate the one and love the other, or else he shall cleave to one and despise the other. You are not able to serve Elohim and Mammon, which is the personification of wealth. Not money. Money is not evil. It's about what we do with it. But the personification of wealth, and you can't help but realize that in Yehuda's journey in Adullam, seeking out a nobleman, Hurrah, and then ultimately marrying into money, Shuva, that there were certain things that he wanted to personify. He wanted to be able to have that throne, per se, in his life and be able to walk it out the way that he wanted to. And it's just, it's an incredible reminder not to get caught up with the things of this world, because if we allow anything to be the forefront, if we chase after money, we chase after success or the personification of wealth or any type of increase that makes us feel much more, then we can't really truly subject ourselves to the Father in the way that He wants us to. And only time, only the test of time will really show where our heart's at in those moments. And I know to a seasoned crowd like everybody here that has plenty of word that these things may seem very elementary. But I'm bringing them forth as they were brought forth to me. And I got to believe with everything in me that that is the genuine word that has to go forth and it will not return void. And if anything, if it's not for anybody to receive, I have to receive it for myself as a continual reminder. So there may be on the horizon for either me or anyone else an increase that could have a slight temptation into it that may compromise our walk. If we compromise in the slightest, it could lead to impaired vision. And as recessive. It goes little by little until we have no choice to throw up our hands and cry out. And I know this may seem like a shorter end to the service as normal, but I was contemplating and praying in regards to moving on to the staff, the cords, and the seal with the signet. And that's something that I don't want to just brush through. They have information on it, but I do want to end the service with Psalms 141 and dealing with our posture, our vision, our ears. This is an all-around checkup by the Father. Jehovah, I have cried out to you. Hasten to me. Give ear to my voice when I cry out to you. Now, the reason that we're here is because this is a prime example of what would have been the better route for Yehuda and his situation, and what can be the better route for us if we just hearken our words to him in the way the Psalms 141 is laid out for us. But let my prayer be prepared before you as incense, the lifting up of my hands as the evening offering. O Yehovah, set a guard for my mouth. Watch over the door of my lips. Sa'ah. Let not my heart be inclined to evil, to practice deeds of wrongness with men working wickedness. So leave Hara alone. And let me not eat of their delicacies. Watch out for the sheep shearing vest. Let the righteous one smite me or reprove me in loving commitment. It is oil on my head. Let my head not refuse it. My prayer is still against their evil deeds. Their judges have been thrown down by sides of the rock, but they have heard. But they have heard my words, for they have been pleasant. Our bones are scattered at the mouth of Sheol, as when one plows and breaks up the earth. But my eyes are upon you. O Master Yehovah, in you I take refuge. Do not pour out my life. Guard me from the clutches of the trap they have laid before me, and from the snares of the workers of wickedness. Let the wrong fall into their own nets while I pass by. And with all that said, and in consideration, it's just another reminder of the fact that through all of what took place, that our Messiah was able to come through that. And it's also a foreshadowing and a picture and a pointing to the fact that whenever Hebrews chapter 7 speaks about that there is a high priest that comes from the line of Judah that Moses never talked about, that this is the establishing point because we're able to connect Shem, Elam, and Tamar to the high priestly household. And that's the same household that Almighty Yah wants us to realize that we're part of. And it is a blessing to be able to serve him in that capacity and to be able to grow in that and learn in that. And I'm thankful for each and every one of you. Shabbat Shalom.